Yes, hello, my name is Hannah, and thank you very much for inviting me to this very nice and exciting workshop. Yeah, as already been said, I'm going to talk about adaptive quantum state tomography with active learning. And I'm going to start with a short review on quantum state tomography, although we've already heard about this in one or the other way in the previous talks. But I'm focusing here on neural network-based quantum state tomography schemes, which I will then use as a basic building block to build up our adaptive active learning scheme. And if we apply this adaptive active learning scheme, we will end up with learning curves, which look like what I show here on the left hand side of the slide. So the aim of this talk here is that we understand what's going on here. What I'm going to present is a work that I did together with Matyas, who is also in the group of Fabian and Annabelle that I'm working with. Quantum state tomography comes into play when we have built a quantum experiment or set up a quantum computer. And on this quantum computer, we can prepare a quantum state. This quantum state is then fully determined by its quantum wave function. That's why, at least from a theoretical perspective, it's pretty easy to obtain measurements from this quantum state. However, if we now have the quantum or the measurements of the quantum state and want to evaluate if our quantum computer works and if it really prepared the state that we actually wanted it to prepare, we want to go in the other direction and want to find out from the measurements how the quantum state looked like. And this is what is called quantum state reconstruction or quantum state tomography, and which is not at all a trivial task. That's why there's like a whole field of research dealing with this topic. And of course, there are already lots of existing schemes for quantum state tomography. However, the existing conventional quantum state reconstruction schemes all have the problem that since the Hilbert space grows exponentially with the system size, also, of course, the number of samples that we need for a good reconstruction scales exponentially. And this is, of course, not what we would like to have. That's why people had the idea to use neural networks for quantum state tomography. And the underlying idea is that most of the physical states that we are normally investigating have a certain degree of structure. And if we are able to learn the structure with neural networks, we can reduce the number of measurements that are needed for a good reconstruction. So one way to use neural networks for quantum state tomography are restricted Boltzmann machines, and Stephanie already explained the structure this morning, so where we have the visible nodes, which are our input data, the measurements that we feed into this machine, and then we have connections and a hidden layer. And all of these things are weighted with weights, which I will call in the following W, B, and C. Restricted Boltzmann machines are able to represent probability distributions. We already heard about this this morning. And the probability distribution is then determined by the weights of the RBM. So if we train the RBM, it just means that we adjust the weights such that the probability distribution of the RBM and the real distribution of our measurements become as close as possible, which is done by minimizing the Kolbe-Leibler divergence. If we now want to use restricted Boltzmann machines to reconstruct quantum states with complex wave function, one way to do this, and I'm following here the work of Giacomo Torlai from 2018, is to use actually two RBMs to reconstruct the wave function, one for learning the amplitude and one for learning the phase structure of the state. So at the end, we get an We get an amplitude for each configuration of our spin system or of our qubits, which is given by the amplitude, which is determined by one RBM, and then we have another RBM, which gives us the information about the phase structure of our state. If we use this RBM-based reconstruction scheme, Giacomo Torlai showed that it is possible to reconstruct highly entangled states with very many qubits. I think they went up to 80 qubits. And this is also what is shown in this plot here, where they used like sub-exponentially many samples and still managed to reconstruct the W state in this case to a very high accuracy. And another very nice thing is that they made the implementation accessible. So you can just download it as a Python package, which is called Qcumber. So at the start of our project, I thought, OK, cool, nice. This is, seems pretty easy now. I can just download this, this package here and reproduce the plot. But when I did it, it turned out to be a bit more complicated. And what I did here is to do a scan over different numbers of measurement configurations that I feed in this RBM machine. And then here I look at 1 minus the fidelity, so I actually want to have the values to be very low. But you can see you don't really have to worry about the states that I'm investigating, but for some states, the reconstruction becomes really bad if I use a certain number of measurement configurations. And it, of course, it also depends on which specific measurement configurations I take and how many samples I take. So what I want to show here is that although the representation itself is capable of representing very complicated quantum states, it really depends on which samples from which configurations I feed in. And at first place, when I don't have any information about my quantum state, it's not clear which configurations I should choose to train my RBM on. In order to tackle this problem, we went from the pure RBM learning scheme, which can also be considered as a passive learning scheme, to something that is called active learning. And in active learning, in contrast to passive learning, the learner is now able to interact with its environment. In our case, this means that the RBM, or actually we will go to several RBMs that form a committee, but I will come to that later. So the RBM can interact with the quantum state and request measurements from certain or from specific measurement configurations that are highly informative, feed it in again, and based on the new information combined with the old information, request new measurements in the next step, and we go on and on until we have a nicely trained RBM representation of our quantum state. So before I go a bit in more detail about or on our active learning scheme, I want to stress again that in the RBM, the pure RBM reconstruction, the wave function, that the reconstructed wave function that we obtain is given by the amplitude, which is only trained on one on samples from one measurement configuration. And from this one measurement configuration via Born's rule, we get directly all, or if we take infinitely many samples, we get all information about the amplitude. And in contrast, the phase is trained on samples which come from different local rotations of our quantum state, so from different measurement configurations. So when we keep this in mind, we can have a look at the second part of our active learning scheme. And here, as I've already mentioned, we train what I will call a committee of RBMs. So let's say 10 different RBMs, or to be more precise, 10 pairs of RBMs, because we have this like pairs for the amplitude and for the phases. So at the end of this step three, we end up with 10 different reconstructions or representations of our quantum states by the RBMs. Then we do something that is called query by committee strategy, and which means that based on the training outcomes of the RBM reconstruction, the RBMs form a committee and decide which samples from which measurement configuration they need next to improve the learning most and to get most of the like information that they are not sure about. Then we measure in the requested configuration, feed it in the RBMs again, and continue until we have reached a good reconstruction. This step four is done by having a look at the variance of the amplitudes and the phases of all of our different RBMs separately. And if the variance of the amplitude of all of our RBMs is larger than the variance of the phases, we directly know that this must or has something to do with our reference configuration. So in this case, we just request samples from the reference configuration. If it's the other way around and the variance of the phases is higher, then we perform rotations on our reconstructed wave function. So not on the real wave function, but on the reconstructed wave function. And again, have a look at the variance for between all the different RBMs. And then we take the measurement configuration as the next query that has the highest variance. In addition to that, we add a first stage of our learning procedure. And this stage has more something to do with a good choice of the reference configuration. And in a very simple picture, you can see that quite easily if you have a look at spin polarized states, one being polarized in the x direction and one being polarized in the CCC direction. If you take the spin polarized state in CCC direction, it's of course most convenient to just measure the amplitude also in this CCC basis. Whereas for the spin polarized state in x direction, we want to measure the amplitude in the xxx direction. And this is done by just making this preliminary stage of learning where we generate samples from our quantum state in the xxx, yyy, and CCC configuration and train the RBMs on each of the data sets separately. And in this case, we take the configuration as the reference configuration, which has the lowest variance in the outcome, because we want to take the configuration which is most promising for reconstructing our quantum state. If we do that, we end up with the learning or with learning curves that typically look like what I also showed on the first slide. So let's have a look at the number of samples during the learning process. At first, this is just what I said. When we go through the blue boxes here, we add more and more samples to our pool of samples that we are training the RBMs on. Then what I also plot is 1 minus the fidelity. So here we want to have a very small value and the Kullback-Leibler divergence. And then we get learning curves for all of the different RBMs in our committee. And you can see that in the first training loop, the RBMs learn, the Kullback-Leibler divergence decreases, and also the reconstruction becomes better. But then when we add more and more samples to our pool of samples, at first place, some of the RBMs, in this case, there's one RBM where the 1 minus the fidelity increases, and then for other stages, others they can become a bit confused by the new information, but this is actually not unintentional in our scheme, since if you think of it, if we have a very big pool of samples all coming from the CCC configuration, and we add only one sample coming from, let's say, the XXX configuration, then it's clear that this might be a bit confusing. But when we add more and more pieces of information on the quantum state into our pool of samples, at some point, all of the RBM can make sense of the information, and the reconstruction becomes very good, and also the Kolbe-Leibler divergence. I compare the results here to the green bar, which I will call the baseline. And this is also a RBM reconstruction for several RBMs. And the band gives us the span of outcomes for different RBM reconstructions. But here, I take the same number of samples and same number of configurations, but I choose the configurations randomly and not with active learning. So yeah, to evaluate the performance of our active learning scheme, we had a look at two groups of quantum states, basically. One that I generated on real quantum devices provided by IBM, and we compared it also to classical simulators of quantum devices. And the other one being ground states that we calculated with DMRG. And here we considered ground states of the XXC model and of a Z2 lattice gauge model. For the states that we generated on IBM quantum devices, we considered the GHC state, and then a GHC state where we added a phase, and then some spin-polarized states to evaluate if our first state of the learning with a good choice of a reference configuration really works. And then like we prepared them, of course, by applying certain gates to our initial state. So for the results, we got results, of course, for the classical simulators and for the quantum devices. And the first thing that you can directly observe is that, of course, the reconstruction for the simulated quantum devices is better, since here we don't have to deal with any noise or some imperfections. But for the real quantum devices, we can see that for all of the considered states, active learning can bring an advantage. So let us just go quickly through all of the states. The first state that we had a look at is the spin-polarized state with spins in the Z direction. Here, active learning and the baseline perform equally well, which is due to the fact that we don't have any phase structure, so we don't really have to care about the rotations. And in addition, the cucumber implementation is done in such a way that the reference configuration is the CCC configuration anyway. So here the default settings are just perfectly fit to our target state. The situation changes already when we go to the state with the spins polarized in X direction, since here a good reference measurement configuration is the XXX direction and not the Z direction. So our active learning scheme is able to see that and to choose the XXX direction as the reference measurement configuration. And then it has a pretty easy task. But if we choose the other measurement configuration, it's much harder. And then we considered the GHC states and GHC state with phase, which are quite hard to learn, or harder to learn since we have entanglement now and so on. And this can be also seen by the fact that we have a quite high variance for our result, for the reconstruction results. But if we now apply active learning, we are able to improve the reconstruction and furthermore also reduce the variance of the outcomes for different RBMs, which makes our reconstruction more reliable. The other group of states were ground states that we generated, or that we calculated with DMRG. So the first ground states that we had a look at are ground states of the XXC model, where we can have a look at different values of the anisotropy delta. If we choose a very high value of delta, we almost get the spin polarized state in the z direction. So here again, active learning and the baseline perform equally well. But if we choose the delta to be zero, we actually expect, or we have a SU2 invariant state. So for the values of the correlator, we actually expect that they should have the same value independently of which direction we have a look, which is also true for the target state. But it seems that the RBM learning scheme has some difficulties, some problems with reconstructing an SU2 invariant state. And the way I explain that to me, but Roger, you can, of course, correct me, is that we train the amplitude and the phases on different levels in the scheme and feed different samples in the amplitude learning and in the phase learning. So I would say that this makes it very difficult in such a delicate case of an SU2 rotationally invariant state. But still, if we choose the measurement configuration smartly and not randomly, we can at least get closer to the SU2 invariants. And the last type of states that I had a look at were ground states of a Z2 lattice gauge model, where we have hardcore bosons sitting on the sides of our system. And then in between, we have a Z2 lattice gauge field and a Z2 electric field, which are denoted by the Pauli Z Pauli matrix and X Pauli matrix. In a lattice gauge model, we always have a gauge generator, and in this case, this generator just gives us a Gauss law, which states that if we have different values of the electric field on both sides of the sides, we get an occupied side, but if we have the same value of the fields, we get empty sides. Another constraint that we can, this can also be written down in a formula where we relate the value of the electric field with the occupation, but it's really just what is also stated here in the picture. And then we can add another constraint, which is the conservation of the number of particles in our system. And if we now rewrite the Pauli matrices just in terms of spin 1/2 operators, we end up with a spin model, but the physics really didn't change, just that we now switched from the electric fields to SX matrices, from the gauge field to SC matrices, and the particles now represent domain walls in our spin system, which you can again see when you have a look at the Gauss law. When we have the same value of the spins pointing in the same direction, we don't get any domain wall, and for different spin directions, we get a domain wall. So this is a very interesting, or this model produces very interesting ground states due to a number of reasons. The first one is that we have this hidden U1 symmetry of the particles, which we transformed now to a hidden U1 symmetry and conservation of domain walls in our system. It also features a certain degree of non-local entanglement. And if we switch off the H here, we have a confinement-deconfinement transition. So this is the reason why we chose this model to test our active learning scheme, since we wanted to see if we can also reconstruct local and non-local observables in this model. And this is what I'm going to show in the next step. But the local observable that we had a look at is the local density in our system. So this is the density of domain walls or particles that are shown here. And if we have a non-zero value of the h, we get Friedel oscillations. And these Friedel oscillations are determined by the wave Fermi momentum. And so they are determined by the filling that we have in our system. And for the target state, we can see like the amplitude and the wave vector that we are expecting in this case. And we can see that even with the baseline, we can somehow like see the wave vector of the oscillations, but to get the amplitudes, like the real qualitative agreement, we need to add active learning. And the same can also be seen for a non-local observable sector correlator, where we have a very good agreement if we apply active learning. But if we just choose the configurations randomly, we get two low values of our correlators. So to conclude, in this talk here, I used restricted Boltzmann machines as a building block of our adaptive active learning scheme. But I want to make clear that the scheme itself does not really depend on this particular representation. You could also use other neural network-based representations like RNNs, but I think you could also use MPS states maybe. And I showed that for the states that we were investigating, which were states that we generated on IBM quantum devices and ground states of the XXC and the Z2-lattice gauge model, we were able to improve the reconstruction results by applying active learning, which you can remember as just smartly choosing the measurement configurations. So as future directions, what we are interested in are other representations of quantum states. I already mentioned RNNs, where already some people in the audience have done some nice work on it. And what also would be interesting is, of course, to extend this to go to finite temperatures. Then we have to consider mixed states or to fermionic systems where we have to anti-symmetrize the wave functions. So with this, I would like to thank you and my collaborators, and I'm happy about any comments or questions.
Thank you very much for the wonderful talks.
Hi, so firstly, thanks for the amazing talk. So I'm just trying to understand the active learning scheme that you used. I think it was in slide 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So here do you basically train all the N RBMs like in parallel or?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Train them in parallel.
And, yeah. What might also be confusing is that we initialize the RBMs with different weights at the beginning. That's why we end up with different reconstructions for all of the different RBMs.
Okay. And so the reason you take like N RBMs is that you want to find like which measurement configuration is the most informative one, I think. So how do you decide like if a measurement configuration is more informative than the previous?
In this case, we decided based on the variance. So the reasoning is that a measurement configuration is most informative if the RBMs are very unsure about the reconstruction in this measurement configuration. So that's why we choose the measurement configurations with a very high variance where the RBMs are very unsure about the reconstruction result.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, my question is very much related. When you're speaking about the variance, is it you ask the RBMs to produce samples on a given basis, and then you ask, oh, are these samples that these different RBMs are producing, are they very far away from each other, or how is this variance measured?
That's a good question. I didn't go into detail on that. So for small systems, we can actually just take the state. Is there? What we do is we take all of the different configurations of our systems, which are, I don't know, sigma 1, sigma 2, and we have a look at the probability that is given by RBM 1, and then we have another with RBM 2. And we can do it for small systems, we can do it for all configurations, and then we just take the variance here for all of the RBMs and sum it up. For large configurations, this is not very efficient, so we just sample configurations with Monte Carlo sampling, and for all the sampled configuration, we do the same.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Any a question?
I think there's.
Thanks again for a really good talk. I wanted to see if you could comment on the scaling of this approach. Like, you've got this GSE state, you trained it on. It's how many RBMs did you use for that, and how many nodes were in each one? And given that, do you see any sort of bottlenecks or future work that would need to be done if you wanted to do larger systems?
Yeah. So here we went up to 20 qubits at the end. And we used RBMs with the same number of hidden nodes than the visible nodes. But I think to evaluate the scaling, we have to separate two things, one being the scaling of the RBMs and one being the scaling of our active learning scheme. For the RBM reconstruction, I think the main bottleneck is that at the end we want to perform rotations on our quantum state, on the reconstructed quantum state, and these rotations become very costly for large configurations because we can't do it locally. So this is one bottleneck, and the other one is of course the one of our active learning scheme, since first of all, yeah, we want to train different RBMs. That was another question. We normally train between five or ten different RBMs. And then if we evaluate the variance, we do it for different rotations, and the number of possible rotations grows exponentially. So what we did already was for the large system sizes to choose a subset of the rotations and then perform our active learning scheme on this subset, which will not be very efficient for larger systems. But when I heard Frederica's talk yesterday, I thought that maybe something like reinforcement learning for this last step would be a nice option. Or, I don't know, Bayesian inference maybe,
So much. It occurs that at the beginning you stated that the number of measurements grows exponentially, and in this now the number of rotations.
No, not the number of configurations that we are really training on, but the number of configurations that we possibly could choose measurements from.
See. Thank you so much.
Any other question? Actually, I have one silly question. So this is like learning the state, right? There's target state, but can I generalize this approach so that like I have several target states? So then two or three or four target states, they are mutually orthogonal, and then I want to reconstruct the state so that that's in the subspace, let's say. I have like quantum error correction in mind.
So do you mean that you have, I didn't like fully understand it, that you have orthogonal states?
Yeah. So I specify not the single state, but the subspace of the total.
Okay, and you'd
I
only...
want to good subspace or not?
So in this case, your measurements would also come from all of these different states. But then I think it would be possible to do the same, because at the end, what we do is we want to match the real distribution of the measurements and the distribution of the RBM. And if the measurements also come from different states, maybe that could be possible. But I haven't thought of the like how this would really work at the end. Yeah.
Thank you.
A question about how in practice this looked when you were working with the IBM device. So like how quick was the process to get the suggested measurement, or like what was that process like, these experiments?
The reconstruction process or the process of measuring?
I guess like getting the suggested measurement from your committee and then taking that measurement.
Okay, yeah, for the RBM states, it was pretty fast because we were only able to have a look at states or at devices with up to 5 qubits. So due to the small system size, it was pretty fast. Then I sometimes had to wait until the quantum device wasn't occupied anymore. That was actually the main like issue there. But in general, as you can see here, this is really a typical thing. You have to go through something like 10 iterations of this process, which of course also depends on how many samples you feed in each iteration.
Maybe I'll ask a question. You talked about the kind of bottleneck in the reconstruction being the rotations and so on. But the data is also difficult to obtain. Were you at the limits in the DMRG case of what the DMRG could produce in terms of data
for
sets?
For the number of samples?
Yeah, for the number of samples.
No, not at all.
Nowhere near.
Yeah, it was like not many samples that we were using. Typically something between 100 or 1,000 samples.
Oh.
Any other question? If not, let's thank the speaker again.
Thanks.